Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 6, the Book of Fate, Canto 1, the Word of Fate. And we'd reached page 427. We stopped at the closing quotation marks in line 439. Narad is at the court of King Aswapati and his queen. Savitri has returned. She has shared her news, her proud news that she has met Satyavan. She says, "My father, I have chosen. This is done." But then Narad is asked to give his blessing, and there seems to be some problem about that. And in what we read last week, the queen has asked him that please give your blessing, or if there is something wrong with that family and with that boy, then also please tell us so that we can avoid this chance entanglement of an alien fate. If there's some reason why we should not get involved in this family, please let us know. And Narad doesn't exactly reply. He said, "What is the use of me telling you what is going to happen in the future? When people are driven by destiny, by fate, he says, safe doors cry, opening near, but the doomed pass on." So there may be ways to escape, but those who are destined, they will pass on to meet their doom. And so that's where we stopped. That nobody and nothing can turn aside the driving of this force of fate. You will read, Stefania?
His words were there. He is unforced to grieve, and helped by calm the swaying wheels of life, and the long restlessness of transiency, and the trouble and passion of unquiet words. As through her own bosom were pierced the mother's soul, the ancient human sentence strike her child. Hers witness that deserve another fate, only a larger measure given of fear. Aspiring to the nature of the God, a mind proof ermost made in mighty thought, a will and desire cushioned behind wisdom's shield. So to still heavens of knowledge she had risen, so calm and wise and Aswapati's queen, human was she still and opened her doors to grief. The stony high injustice she accused of the marble godhead of inflexible will, not so the strength of extreme adversity brings to light that stand erect and front the world power. Her heart appealed against the impartial judge, touched with perversity the impersonal one. her tranquil spirit she called not to her age, but as a common man beneath his load, grows faint and breathes his pain in ignorant words. So now she arraigns the world in perfect years.
Thank you, we'll stop there. So Narad speaks as an immortal, one of those who is not like us human beings, obliged to grieve. He doesn't have to suffer grief. He is one of those higher beings who help by their calm the swaying wheels of life, as if life is a chariot which is rushing through over a rough road, but somehow containing and supporting that rough journey, there's the calm of the higher beings. So he is one of those, and so he can speak as he has spoken. That we just have to accept the workings of fate. This has all been predestined, and nothing can be changed, and nothing that I can say will help. But Savitri's mother doesn't react with the same calm. She feels it's as if an arrow has pierced her own heart, and she sees that her child, for whom she wishes for everything happy and good, that she has been given this ancient human sentence that you must suffer, and that this beautiful young woman has been given a larger measure of tears. She's so sweet and she's so beautiful. She deserves a better fate, but she's given a greater measure of tears than even ordinary human beings. The queen is quite a developed person. She's calm and wise and Aswapati's queen, but she's still human. And she still opens the doors of her heart to grief. And she accuses the stony-eyed injustice and all this laws of the universe. Sri Aurobindo says that she doesn't look for the strength which can come when we have to face extreme adversity, if there's something very, very difficult and challenging that comes up in our life, that's an opportunity to find a great inner strength within. But she doesn't do that. No? Instead, she accuses, she taxed with perversity the impersonal one, the supreme law. But she says, how can this be? It's so unfair. She has a tranquil spirit, but she doesn't call that to help her. She reacts just like an ordinary person, any ordinary person. Queens and kings and aristocrats are supposed to be better, higher in consciousness than ordinary people. It's natural that ordinary people, with their hard lives, that they will grow faint and complain in ignorant words. But she shouldn't do that, but that's what she does. Now she arraigns, she accuses the world's impassive will. Sri Aurobindo uses Savitri's mother. He's brought her into his poem as the mouthpiece, the one who speaks on behalf of us ordinary human beings who breathe our pain in ignorant words. Yes. No, no, I finished.
I'm interested to know Camille or Jeanine or someone. The French, is it ancien, for ancient? And the French definition of the word ancient, is that
ancient?
Yes.
The ancient human sentence. Here it's implying that this has been the fate of humanity far, far back, as long as we can see. The ancient human sentence.
Is it from French?
Well, but it's in English, ancient.
But in French, does it have any nuance?
No, it's fair.
And here the sentence is the sentence that a judge gives, you know, as if we are guilty of some original sin and therefore we have to suffer, we've got to be punished.
I think that in these passages we are facing a terrible situation, because the king and the queen, they are not in front of a doctor that is giving, say, your child has an illness that it cannot be cured or something like that, so that you can change the doctor and go for other advice. Here Narad is the voice of the God. There is no way to escape.
Yes. Yes.
So their position is...
They feel that there's something that can't be changed. That's definitely what Narad is expressing. None can refuse what the stark force demands. Something inevitable. But still, like human beings, we try to resist even and oppose and complain about even what is inevitable. This description that he gives of Savitri's mother, we have seen it from the beginning, that she was very developed person. So even very developed human beings, where their feelings are affected, they can open their doors to grief. It's the reaction of the mother. Her child is threatened. So all these higher mental realizations are not enough to help us sometimes in those extreme situations.
It's interesting. I don't have mind on this, but stony-eyed injustice. And Shobindo says the stony-eyed injustice, not a stony-eyed.
It's the stony-eyed injustice of the marble godhead of inflexible law. That something is fixed and it's just like a statue in stone and you are not going to be able to change it. And we human beings, we think, oh, it should not be like that. And we want to change. Yes, Eric.
The queen, the queen has a proof-armed mind, if I understand well.
Yes.
Is that, as far as you know, because of some experiences in her life?
This is because of the education that she's been given, the culture that she's been given, the ideals that were placed before the aristocracy at that time, these Vedic ideals, no? So the idea that human life is meant for spiritual development, for developing one's capacities, and at least this starts with mental self-discipline. So she's experienced all that, and she's aspiring for higher consciousness. So the mind has been developed and taught to be positive, courageous. The will is also disciplined. It's not, it's entire. It's not wanting this thing today and something else tomorrow. It's a disciplined, focused will. And he uses this word, which I don't know how to pronounce actually. If it were French, we would say couchant. But if we read the English spelling, we would say couchant, which sounds a bit strange to my ears. It's a word that's used in heraldry. Heraldry. Heraldry is the science, the knowledge about the symbols for identifying aristocratic families. And they have the signs on their shields or on their flags. And a person who knows how to read that, they will know which family somebody has come from and whether he's a first son or a second son and or an illegitimate son and so on. So one of the symbols that's used, they use animals, often lions are there, no? And the position that the lion is in is significant of a particular family. So some lions are standing up on their hind legs and roaring and have their claws out. That is rampant. Which is also from French. But some lions are lying down peacefully. They are on guard. They are couchant. Yeah.
Remember, a lot of French words that come into English are given more or less French pronunciations. So I think my number is couchant.
Yes, yeah. And of course, all these things come from French because it was when Britain was invaded by the Normans that all these things came. So for 300 or 400 years, all words that had to do with authority and law and military purposes and even food, very, very many French words came into English at that time. And these words of heraldry, they are still used today. I once met a herald years ago in London, and there are four chief heralds in the country who organize everybody's heraldry and their symbols and their genealogies and all that. And then they have an office, the Office of Heralds. So he was one of those four people. But I never really asked him much about his work. I suppose he was a kind of lawyer. So they keep this vocabulary current, this vocabulary in words and this vocabulary in symbols. All the colors also are significant, and the way that the signs are divided.
I have one question. If the stone-eyed justice or something, is this one of the four powers of the unconscious, or something that Richard Harris has talked about? There was kind of this denial.
I don't think it is that.
No.
I think this is the Godhead of law. And we know that this Godhead is named in the tradition. This is Yama, who is best known as the god of death, and he's the god that Savitri is going to have to face. But his job is also keeping everything in the universe in its place. So he has a positive aspect also. He's also Dharma. He's the law that rules everybody and everything differently, each in their place. So we human beings, we don't see that. Something comes which appalls us, and we think it's an injustice. We accuse, we say it's so unjust. But Aswapati already said it, that even if things look bad, only for good the secret will can work. He has already said that. He saw that there's a shadow over Satyavan's head, but then he sees that shadow being swept away by light. So he is not expressing all these human feelings. This is coming from Savitri's mother. Shall we go on, Marco?
What's there to do has crept across her path, emerging from the dark forest's sullen heart? What evil things stood miles by the way and wore the beauty of the sharper boy? Perhaps it came an enemy from her past, armed with a hidden force of ancient forms, himself unknowing, and seized her unknown. Her dreadfully entangled love and hate made us blind wanderers mid the perils of time. Our days are lived of a disastrous chain. Necessity avenges casual steps. Old cruelties come back unrecognized. The gods make use of our forgotten deeds. Yet all in vain the bitter law was made. Our own minds are the justices of doom. For nothing have we learned but still repeat our stark misuse of self and other souls.
Thank you. For here she is invoking the law of karma, which we've been reading about in the Life Divine class recently, the kind of beliefs that people have about karma, the results of our actions. So the mother is asking, what kind of doom, of bad destiny has secretly crept across Savitri's path, coming out of the dark heart of the forest. Some evil thing, something bad, has put on the appearance of this beautiful young prince of Shalva. No? And perhaps he's coming to her as an enemy from her past. So this week, meet in all the traditional stories again and again, no, that there are fated relationships that have been carried on from previous incarnations. Perhaps something wrong has been done to him in the past, and now that gives him strength to come and bring about something terrible for our family. And he himself doesn't know anything about it, no? And he doesn't know what he's doing, even. This happens, she says, because love and hate in our world are dreadfully entangled, tied up together. And we human beings, we are blind wanderers. We are just wandering and we don't know where we're going or where we have come from. We're passing through all these perils of time. And all our days are links in a chain. I've got a chain today. There's a force of necessity that things that we do, things that we have done, they have consequences. And those consequences are going to come back and affect us. So things that we did just casually, thoughtlessly, necessity will come and give the just payment. Perhaps we've done something cruel in the past, comes back to us, we don't recognize it. And the gods, the cosmic powers, they make use of our forgotten deeds to give us what we deserve in the present. But she says, and as Sri Aurobindo says in the Life Divine, this system of rewards and punishments is not much use. It doesn't have much educational effect because we are not aware. We carry out the sentence ourselves. We don't learn to do better. We haven't learned anything. We still go on repeating the way that we misuse ourselves and other people. So this is one problem with the idea of karma. And then she develops a slightly different idea about love, Mihong.
There are things of the human heart, and falling from the superior element, love darkens to the feet of a nigger god. The dreadful angel, angry with his joy, woundingly sweet, he cannot yet forego, is pitiless to the soul, his gaze disarmed. He visits with his own pain, his quivering face, forcing us to cling in armor to his feet, as if in love with our own agony.
Thank you. Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask anything?
I would like to ask something about
Pitipa. Yes, please. Sorry, I rushed on.
Can you talk something about the Shalva boy?
The Shalva boy. Yes. Satyavan is the prince of Shalva. He is the son of the ruling family of the country of Shalva.
Supposed to be in Gujarat.
Shalva is, I believe I have been told, somewhere in the western Terai of Nepal, the foothills of the Himalayas. He says something.
What does this say?
Shalva,
a country in western India, being possibly Rajasthan. And by transference, the honorific name Puru's king, the home of King Dumitsena and his son Satyavan.
So they put it in Rajasthan.
Possibly.
Rajasthan. So I'm going off a map that I've seen as an illustration.
There's still today a place called Shalva?
No, I don't know about that.
You're aware of it?
No, no, I think we have to research on it.
Yeah.
I think it's very relevant.
It's clearly described as a country which is in Shrilbindo's poem, as a country which is on the foothills of the Himalayas. That beyond other is the iron line of the high peaks, the bare peaks. And I'm going from a map I have seen illustrating the Mahabharata. So there Madra is shown more up towards Kashmir or Afghanistan, and Shalva is here on the what would now be we call the Terai, the western Terai.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a center there now. Shrivindra Yoga Mandir is in the Terai Valley of Nepal.
Yes.
So maybe we can find out.
Yes.
There was no such thing as India as a country at that time. No?
They had
one
some. It wasn't a united government for the whole country, but there was obviously some sense of one culture, a shared culture, embracing more or less the whole peninsula, it
and
seems.
I wondered if what is now Nepal was ever part of India.
Of course, it's part of.
It's
part of Bharat, no? Even right up into Afghanistan, Gandhara and these places, these were considered part of Bharat. So where were we? We were here with love and the dire alchemies of the human heart. Love is such a wonderful angel, such a transforming power, but in the human heart it can get distorted and darkened.
So is the angel?
Yes, is love. Yes. Then he, we know these distortions, the way that jealousy and possessiveness and all these nether gods can darken love in the human heart. And then there's this powerful attraction because it is love, but it can become very painful to both partners. We are as if addicted to our own suffering.
It
sounds like it has been posed on human
experience. This angel
has
gone through all this.
Yeah, this is the angel who's got transmuted by this dire alchemy. Alchemy is supposed to turn everything to gold, everything to its perfect form. No? But a dire alchemy just does the opposite. It turns things to their negative forms. They're just the opposite of what they should be.
And we are the
prey. We are the prey of this angel once he's got hold of us. We all recognize how helpless we are against the force of love. Either in his golden or his darker form.
Or perhaps some kind of love.
Sorry?
Or perhaps some kind of love.
Yes, that's what he's talking about, the way that love can manifest itself in darkened ways.
He sees one poignant misery in the world, and grief has other lessons for our life. Our sympathy become our torturers. Trained have I my own punishment to bear, knowing it just, but on this earth perplexed, smitten in the sorrow's cold and helpless sea. Often it faints to meet other suffering eyes. We are not as a god who know not grief, and look impassive on the suffering world. Calm they gaze down on the little human sea, and the short-lived passion crossing mortal hearts. An ancient tale of hope can move us still. We keep the gate of rest that leads no more. We are shaken by the sight of human pain and share the miseries that others feel. powers now, the passions, the that cannot be. Too hard for us in heaven's indifference. Our own tragedies are not enough for us. All pathos and all sufferings we may cause. We have so room for greatness passed away and feel the touch of tears in mortal things. Even as changes anguish lands my heart, and this all my life is my well of trust.
Thank you. It's beautiful, no? In this passage that Jean-Yves read, there are three lines that echo a passage in the epic of Virgil, the Aeneid. One of them is a very famously untranslatable line, which I'm just seeing if I can remember.
Latin,
yes. Sunt lacrimae rerum et mentem mortalia tangunt. There are tears in things. In things. But I mean, it's famously untranslatable. Nobody's translated it really exactly, but it's so suggestive. There are tears in things. And what does he say? We feel the touch of tears in mortal things. Idea. And it's a passage where Aeneas, on his journey, he's had to leave Troy when it was destroyed, and he's traveling. Doesn't really know where he's going. He's destined, of course, to land up in Italy and found Rome. But on the way, he shipwrecked on the north coast of Africa, and he and his men are taken to the queen of that kingdom, the queen of Carthage, Dido. And she says these things. When he tells all her suffering, his suffering, then she weeps. She says, an ancient tale of woe can move us still. No. And then she says something like, we have sorrow for a greatness passed away. What a tragedy, the fall of Troy. No. And then this, we feel the touch of tears in mortal things. So that's somehow an echo in the back of this passage.
Dido also called very deeply in love with Aeneas.
When he left, she committed suicide. Terribly sad. So that's one of those ancient tales of woe that still moves us.
Yeah, that word ancient appears three times so far. It's been an old thing. It's really good.
So even a stranger's anguish can rend our heart, tear our heart. And this or another is my well-loved child. So don't expect me to be indifferent and calm and accept this. This is something very, very painful. Ganga Lakshmi, you like to read?
Yes. Hide not from us our doom, if doom is ours. This is what an unknown face says. The terror on whose mute face more than seen. Behind our sea by day, our coach by night, the fate left in the shadow of our heart. The anguish of the unseen that waits for sky. The moon is the best, whether hard to be.
Thank you.
To bear, sorry.
So this is also very human, no? That we.
Sorry?
This is also very human, that we want to know, even if it's very bad, with this urge to know the future. It's maybe not at all the best, but we feel to know is best, however hard to bear. An unknown face of fate, that's something unbearable. No? That you know something dreadful is going to happen, but you don't know what it is or where it is going to come or when it is going to come.
But on the other side of this is to feel not human. So that solidifies the idea of what it is to be human.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes. To be human is to be susceptible to suffering, to sympathy, to all this. Yes. We are not as the gods. No, she says it. And the gods who know not grief and they look down impassive on a suffering world. That's something alien to us that we find difficult to accept. Yeah. Yes.
But the hard thing to realize is that not what Mother said in this drama. It is the love of drama.
In
and
us.
Even death is drama.
Yes.
So that is the part that's really hard to get rid of. So if there isn't a drama in the outer life, they'll create one on the stage.
Yes, that's right.
Or in the film, they want it. It's hard to get rid of that taste for it. That's why these things keep happening.
So with this, you that gods then have only higher emotions like bliss or peace, joy.
Yeah, particularly calm. You know, they are not bothered about all our little troubles down here.
Some people think that's hardness and cruelty, but doesn't react. Emotionally, they get upset. I've heard of this woman, one of Ramchandra's people from Nepal is in ashram. He told me his mother was very traumatized by the earthquake. So he's thinking to go back to her. So I implored him, I said, please you ask the mother first if you should go. Because I said, you go with a human thing. When my mother wanted me to come back to Florida when she was living alone, I prayed to Mother and I thought I shouldn't go. If I had gone, we would have been stuck in the worst hurricane season and never hit Florida. Because I didn't go, she was taken to Las Vegas, she was taken away from all that. So the grace will act if you don't respond with your humanness. That's too much, no? Because how can you relieve another person's pain? You cannot relieve. You can pray for them to have a force descend, a peace descend. But the parents often think, oh, I just have to have my child with me, it will take away my pain.
Yes, what a mistake. I want to say something to Andres's question. There's a beautiful passage in Book 1, Canto 4, where Sri Aurobindo speaks about the two ends of things, and that our problem is that we are not able to join the two ends of things. And then he describes the two ends of things. But there's on higher levels, there are the spirit's absolute potencies in their power. And they are not concerned at all with any of our troubles. They look on that, they support it with their calm, but they are not intervening, they will not intervene. They don't listen to our prayers, those are just meaningless. No. But then he says, but there is a spiritual aid, there is a help that comes from above. And at the same time, the other end of things, there's all this evolutionary process of nature, the way that the divine force is unfolding and working in nature and carrying us clay gods. We are going to be made into something wonderful and miraculous, and that's the work that nature is doing, you know? And there are these two ends, and between them is this spiritual secret aid, which is making sure that everybody's destiny gets fulfilled, that nothing can take away from us our spiritual destiny, you know? So I don't know whether that helps.
No, that's perfectly illustrated in that animation film that was shown in Ashramir that they done in Oruro, Invisible Yoga. Have you all seen it? So they show the two ends of things are these two triangles of Sri Aurobindo's symbols. So when they meet together, then the power you said that is looking out for everything is in the Sri Aurobindo, in that avatar and the lotus in the middle.
The divine presence, which is always with us.
And it's in that flower you have there, Ananda in the physical. So these are the two ends meeting.
To interrupt you here, I thought involution and evolution coming together is the symbol.
Yes,
it's a symbol which has a very rich and complex meaning. So we can think of it like that. There's the involution and there's the evolution, and there's the square in the middle where there's the waters of existence, and there's the lotus on floating on the water. This is the divine presence in everything.
And then you can float on all the troubles of life. Everything rolls off the lotus leaf, you know, never gets.
That's right. So anyway, she has demanded to know, and now Narad is going to tell her. Larry.
Then cried the sage, piercing the mother's heart, forcing to steal the will of Savitri. His words set free the spring of cosmic fate. The great gods use the pain of human hearts as a sharp axe to hew their cosmic robe. They squander lavishly men's blood and tears for a moment's purpose in their faithful work. This cosmic nature's balance is not ours, nor the mystic measure of burning dangers. A single word lets loose vast agencies. A casual act determines the world's fate. So now he set free destiny in that hour.
Thank you. This fate which Savitri has to face is something of universal significance. It's not just a personal, individual significance. No? So when he speaks, that spring which is holding back cosmic fate is set free. Things start to unroll. No? And then Sri Aurobindo tells us that this pain of human hearts, the cosmic powers use that to cut through their road, the road of evolution, the road of divine purpose. They seem to squander lavishly, wasting, spendthrift, unnecessarily, men's blood and tears. They don't care how much blood and tears, human blood and tears, they spend to achieve a moment's purpose in their fateful work.
You mean for the collective progress they are using these disasters?
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
That's what he seems to mean. I how I read these words.
So if a person took the attitude that the divine grace is behind it and felt that indeed it had happened for a reason, a good reason, then they wouldn't have it.
They might still have to suffer terribly, but maybe it would give them the strength and the courage. There are terrible things going on in the world today, no? We wonder how people can have the courage to face their lives. We are so blessed here, we don't know what is going on. But all this is serving some purpose.
It has been said, and just listen to this, that the great terrible thing that's going on in the world now is because of the incredible increase in population, and therefore the greatest blessing that could happen to the face of this earth and humanity itself
is we can all get wiped out.
That everything but about 500,000 are wiped out. Now we leave that alone.
It's a human opinion.
Of course.
But I was struck by something I heard on the BBC, one of these valiant Israeli rescuers. He asked this question after they pulled this Nepali woman out for 1824, after 130 hours, he asked this penetrating question, where did she get the strength to endure that long?
Yeah.
I thought, coming from a man like that, you know.
Mm.
But it was, and I thought, because she's an Indian.
Mm.
So the power of endurance.
An Indian woman, mother says, they've learned to endure. That is what they have learned.
He was amazed.
She told that to Sunil when his mother was dying.
But the divine takes care of his own, because that 15-year-old boy they pulled out, he, like Krishna, he had butter to eat. Huh? He had two bottles of ghee right nearby and water coming down. It was like the divine, and that really made me laugh. And the boy looked good, you know, and they pulled him out. It was simply miraculous. And then these two young teenage lovers, they fell 200 feet and survived. They were up in that tower. They were up on the 8th floor of the viewing tower of that ancient, ancient, from the 19th century. The thing collapsed completely. They fell down in the rubble and they still
survived. They survived. Mm.
So
anyway, that's my listening to this passage,
yes.
I was brought back. I was brought back to some ancient Greek tragedies.
Yes.
Before he evoked Virgil, and now here he introduces an escamotage, something that. In the ancient tragic, you have a group of people that commented what is going on.
Yes, a chorus. Yeah.
A chorus and the rhythm.
Yes, this is like the chorus.
It's just the rhythm of this sentence, as if I was listening to one of those that I listened to performed in a wonderful way.
Yes.
And they always scared you a little bit because they put it in a,
Yes, so that you are exactly right. No, these lines. These are the chorus speaking. Then cried the sage, and then to the bottom. So now he felt set free, destiny in that hour. What Larry read. It's the Sri Aurobindo's comment. On what is happening. No, the drama is going on. Savitri's mother is speaking, Narad is speaking, Aswapati is speaking. Now Narad is going to speak again, but there's this little comment in between that helps us to understand what is going on.
Focus you on something specific.
Yes. And to intensify the drama, he says, look, now what he's going to say, this is crucial. Yes. So, what is he going to say? Sorry, Ganga Lakshmi.
Shobindo said, when I talk about woman, when I come in woman, I understand that he's a god. The woman is god. He is the inner chandelier of the mother. He's a crime about woman. Very, 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 very important.
Thank you. So, will you read?
The truth thou hast claimed, I give to thee the truth. A mother of the meeting earth and heaven, is he whom Savitri has chosen with man. His figure is the front of nature's mind. His single being itself the works of time. A sapphire parting from the sleep of heaven. Delightful is the soul Satya. A way out of the rapturous infinite, a silence waking to a hymn of joy, a divinity and kingliness girt his brow. His eyes keep a memory from a world of bliss, as brilliant as a lonely moon in heaven. Gentle like the sweet bud, extreme desires, pure like a stream that kisses silent banks. He takes his bright surprise, spirit and sense, a living note of golden paradise, a blue immense that leads to the longing world, time's joy borrowed out of eternity. A star of splendor or a rose of bliss.
Thank you. one of the features of the traditional story, the legend, the Mahabharata legend, about the tale of Satyavan and Savitri, is this outstanding quality of Satyavan. What a special being he is. And in the story, this is brought out at the time when death comes to take him away. Yama comes himself, and Savitri asks him, she says, "Lord, usually you will send your messengers. Why have you come yourself?" And then death explains what a very, very special being Satyavan is, and for that reason he has to do him the honor of coming himself to take him away. So this is being brought out here by Narad, what an exceptional being Satyavan is. From the human point of view, from the symbolic point of view, Sri Aurobindo has told us that Satyavan represents the soul of the individual human being, the soul of the world. But as a being here on earth, he says, "I give to you the truth that this person that that Savitri has chosen amongst all other human beings, he's a marvel of meeting earth and heaven." And all the beautiful poetic descriptions which follow of Satyavan's being, they express this meeting of earth, of humanness, and of height of heaven, higher consciousness. So this is a kind of reassurance to Savitri's mother, or anyway, he's telling the truth now, the whole truth. That he's like leading the evolutionary march, nature's march. His figure is the front of nature's march, just like Savitri seems to represent a superhuman, a new race. He is also like that. His single being excels the works of time. He's just the most wonderful product of evolution. And his soul is as if it's a piece of sapphire that's been cut from heaven. That is, he's so delightful. And he's a ray coming all the way from the rapturous infinite, from the world of bliss. And he's a silence, that silence of the origin of things, but waking up, being expressed as a hymn of joy. His brow, the brow is a very, Sri Aurobindo always treats it as a very expressive indication of the nature of any of his characters that he's describing. So he says kingliness, it's as if he's wearing an invisible crown. But also there's a quality of divinity, of superhuman quality, something which is not just kingliness, something beyond. And there's something in his eyes that seem to be carrying a memory from the world of bliss. And he describes him as a lonely moon in heaven, a moon with no stars. He's shining like that. And he's also like a sweet bud, all the sweetness and youthfulness of the spring. So when people see him, he's pure like a stream. Water, of course, is a symbol of purity. But he's a stream. It's not just water It's touching the banks, it's kissing the banks, loving the earth that's channeling it. So everybody who sees him, they are taken with bright surprise. In their spirit is surprised and their senses are surprised. And then he says, a living knot of golden paradise, a blue immense, he leans to the longing world. Time's joy borrowed out of eternity. A star of splendor or a rose of bliss. I think these are four very, very interesting lines.
I'd like to meet someone like that.
This blue immense, it's like the vast sky, you know, leaning down to embrace the longing world. Heaven in that sense. But also in that sky, there's this living knot of golden paradise, something like a sun shining there. And what he represents is the joy, the delight of time, which has been borrowed from the timeless world. And we can experience him like a star of splendor, like a sun, or like a rose. A rose that is the epitome of beauty and delight and ananda, something very close and near and sweet. So in him, soul and nature are equal presences. They balance, they fuse, they are one in a wide harmony. Eric, you would read? The happy and...
I started saying that my name is Stone.
Oh, how have I got the idea that you are Eric?
Yes.
What is your name?
Tone.
Tone. Okay, I am so sorry that I got that wrong. I've been calling you Eric for weeks.
That's why I'm
making the point, yes. Thank you. Tone, please.
The happy in their rise either have not hearts more sweet and true than this of mortal make that takes all joy as the world's native gift and to all gives joy as the world's nature is right. His speech carries a light of inner truth, enlarged eyed communion with the power. In common place has made fearless his mind, the sheer in earth shapes of carver's feet. Tranquil breath of sky, limitless and still, watching the world like a mind of unblown thought, a silent space, musing and luminous, uncovered by the morning to delight the green tangle of trees upon a happy hill, made into a murmuring nest by southern winds. These are his images and parallels, his skin in beauty and in depth, his tears.
Thank you. Anything to be explained? A veil is a covering, so his mind has no covering, it is veilless. When Satyavan first introduced himself to Savitri, he explained to her that he had grown up in nature and that he had been able to feel the power that is behind all these common appearances. So that's referred to here, that he had a large-eyed, open-eyed communication with the power that's supporting living in all common things. And because of that communication, his mind has become very, very clear and pure. He has a pure perception. So he's able to see in earth shapes, in all these common things, he's able to see the divine power behind. Garbless deity. Garbless means without any clothing. Pure, unveiled deity. He can see that presence in all the common things. So shall we stop there for today? I think I said to start at number 9. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 10, yes.
10.
Mm. Yeah, we won't do so many. Just do 3. 10, 11, 12.
Then cried the say, piercing the mother's heart, forcing to steal the will of Savitri. His words set free the spring of cosmic faith. The truth thou hast to claim, I give to thee the truth. Heaven's greatness came, but was too great to stay. 12 swift-winged months are given to him and her. This day returning, Satyavan must die. But the queen cried, vain then can be heaven's grace. Mounting thy car, go forth, O Savitri, and travel once more through the peopled land. Plead not thy choice, for death has made it vain. But Savitri answered from her violent heart, once my heart chose and chooses not again, the word I have spoken can never be erased. It is written in the record book of God.
Thanks to Shervinder.
In the original Mahabharata, there is no comment about the queen after Satyavan is brought back by Savitri. There's no comment. I don't think she...
No, but she's in the Mahabharata version, she's not mentioned at all.
Oh, really?
Shervinder has put her because she didn't want
us to have
to say all this.
That's such a common attitude that she's got. And that's really.
My aunt and I want to present to Savitri Bhavan this. And the reason why is a kind of sense of aesthetics.
Oh.
That's an ugly little fellow.
Oh.
And would you please replace it with this?
Oh, how very nice.
Yes. I think it's better to put like a little screw and hang it. But
Murugan will see to this.
Yeah.
Don is giving us a clock to keep here.
So it's hanging by a wire. But do you have a drill?
No. We have it.
Well, however you feel to do it there. It's a nice
somehow
wooden clock.
I can tell you.
That's
after my show.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you. began to really learn what my body had to say.
What you were telling about women, isn't it great that there's a royal princess? I think. Did you see that baby's
face? I don't
care.
I don't, because
they had little sister. It'll mean a lot for a lot of people, no? Mm-hmm. And it was so sweet, and her face looked so sweet.
I was quite late last night, thinking that maybe they're going to bring her out and show her.
They were out by 6 p.m. She'd gone in at 6 a.m.
But
she was out.
What was that?
The baby, the other baby came, took 10 hours. This baby's a Shakti. She came out in 2 hours and something. My God, she's going to be a power out.
So, I have a present for you from me and Samadarshan, of course. We are leaving on the 11th, but maybe next Sunday we'll be here.
I was thinking when they invent an AC that runs on solar power, the first thing we will do is put one
blue
and
everything.
Yes, that's the subject.
Because here is not closed.
I want to show you this one.
Yes, what's this?
You know this flower? You recognize this flower?
This is wisteria.
Yeah.
And this is, Mother took the Japanese name of this flower as her name.
That's right. She loved it so much.
And it's poet's ecstasy.
Exactly. And only flower name which connect to poetry. This poetic ecstasy, which is what I wanted to see. So when I went there to this community, I gave a speech about Mother, how much she loved this flower.
Yes.
And she even called herself by that name. So these older women, they went to this blossoming time yesterday with a photograph of Mother and Sri Aurobindo. And somehow they felt her presence will be there.
Mm.
So these ladies...
Sure it was there.
Yeah, sorry. So they went and celebrated, Mother's presence there.
Mm.
I was there last year.
Yes.
And so I thought maybe...
This is in Tokyo or Kyoto?
It's in, at the foothills of Mount Fuji. Fujinomiya.
Mm.
Yeah. So just
thank you for the sharing.
Yeah. Mm.